It was an oddly quiet afternoon, many remembered later. Looking back, people recalled that no birds sang, no raucous seagulls screamed over the docks. There was not a dog or a cat in sight, but no one paid attention to the signs. Will Dunham was a young father of three on March 27, 1964. He was driving his truck home after longshoreman's duty on the day shift on the Seward docks.
I thought I'd broken a shock because the car was banging and thumping around. And then I looked and I saw the trees laying over and coming back, and I said, where the hell did the wind come from? And then all of a sudden I saw a big fissure open up in the road in front of me.
The real shock came when he reached his driveway.
Kids were jumping over the fissures as they were opening up. One was 3.5 feet wide, 13 feet deep, went through and split my house.
Welcome to a special edition of A Closer Look. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Today, we'll be hearing stories about a day no Alaskan can forget. On March 27, 1964, a 9.2 monster earthquake, the largest to ever rock North America, roared out of the Chugach Mountains north of Prince William Sound. It took down the towns of Chenega and Valdez and demolished a good portion of Anchorage's downtown area. Seward, on the edge of Resurrection Bay, suffered horrifying damage from the quake itself, but the seven tidal waves that followed added their load of misery to an already devastated community.
It sounded to me like drums, big drums beating, way off in the mountains, and pretty kept coming closer and closer and closer, and all at once the ground we were standing on was just rolling up and down.
Mac Eads remembered. First the shaking, then the rush of water. Eads and his brother Bob were on beachfront land outside town when the quake hit.
We looked halfway down the bay there, and we see the waves standing up on with the white comber on top, and we decided to move to get out of here.
They drove separate vehicles in a scramble to reach downtown.
When that wave was coming down on us, we didn't worry about it too much because we knew that from being sailors that waves out on the ocean travel about 15, 18 miles an hour. This baby was going about 50 miles an hour. There was white water peeling right off the top of it.
But they could not outrun the first wave.
And I came behind them in a military pickup, three-quarter ton pickup, which had no windows in it. And I never went 20 feet where that wave hit me right in the back and just started going end over end like this. I didn't even know which way was up, and everything went black because that water was all mud, you know, you couldn't see anything.
Mac Eads' military truck was tossed into the cottonwoods and twisted like aluminum foil. Dock timbers carried by the wave rained down and around the vehicle. He huddled in the cab.
And they were going right with me, and they were just hammering that pickup to a pulp now. And I knew if I ever got out of it, I would never survive one of those blows with one of those timbers, so I just stayed in there as long as I could.
He was underwater. Dirt and debris started clogging his nose and mouth.
And a good swimmer can't swim in those tidal waves because it's not very much water. It's mostly dirt and debris, like thin cement, you know. My driver's window was open, and I just stood up in there and propelled myself up out of that pickup into the water and over the side. Then about that time, the wave started going back to the ocean, started taking me back.
He clung to an alder as the water drained away and finally lay there like a beached sea lion. Bob Eads and a friend were driving ahead of his brother when the wave crashed over their car.
We couldn't get out of the car because we was pinned in between the big trees that were in here, and we had to kick a window out to get out of the vehicle. And that's when we got out and jumped up on that boat that slammed into our car, and we got up on top of that boat deck and we could visually see around what was happening. Everything we owned here was gone.
But they heard bellowing below them and pulled Mac to safety. Incredibly, both brothers survived. Three clocks now hang on the wall of the Seward Library Museum. Their old-fashioned hour and minute hands are rigid, frozen at the exact moment of the quake, 5:36 p.m.
All three of them stopped at the time of the earthquake, and we've kept them that way, one from City Hall and another from the postmaster's office. I think that one might have been a bit off and saved for all eternity.
Kate Ruland is the museum's curator. Interviews archived by the Seward Museum tell the firsthand accounts of those who lived through that awful evening and through the night that followed.
I was a sophomore in high school, and so not having school on a Friday was reason to be happy.
Linda McRae McSwain was in high school that day. She and her brother Doug were at home at 5:36.
This movement started and the house was shaking and it just wouldn't stop. It just continued. And not only did it continue, but it just became stronger and stronger and stronger. And it was just that real violent, sharp shaking.
The ground was like it was alive. Buckling and cracks were opening, and then looking at Mount Marathon, the trees were whipping violently back and forth. I mean, really whipping back and forth. But the strange thing was there was absolutely no wind. It was dead calm.
When the earth stopped shaking, their dad told each of them to go collect a few personal items. Linda chose her prom dress. Then he piled the family in the car and drove to another subdivision up the road and to what he thought would be safety.
But what we could see as we were driving was that Seward looked like it was completely on fire because all of these oil drums from the downtown had ruptured and just huge flames and black smoke.
He left his family there to go back to see what he could do to help the town, but he didn't get far. Neighbors screamed to him that the wave was coming. He threw the car into reverse and backed up to the house.
All of a sudden, just at the front door was my father, and he's yelling, "There's a tidal wave coming. We have to get to the top of the roof."
The whole family had time only to climb onto the roof of a one-story home.
And so we started jumping one after the other. I remember I jumped with the baby. This is a brand new baby. Little Doug wasn't even 4 weeks old yet.
Dad and I went up last, and we were just about to the peak of the roof when we first saw the wave coming through these big cottonwood trees.
Their story defies imagination.
We jumped, and it seems as if as soon as my dad got onto the house roof, and we were all lying down with our hands and heads at the pitch of the roof and holding hands, that wave just hit so hard and so fast that just in an instant, what had been a subdivision of probably 11 homes was instantly just gone. Everything just exploded or flattened, and we went from the ground up to the very tops of those trees. We were just like a cork, just 0 to 60 in just a split second.
The first wave tore the house off its footing and swept it into the trees.
We weren't swept off by the wave or by enormous tree branches. We all just held on and we just rode, sort of like Dorothy and the Wizard of Oz.
As we were spinning around, we got stuck between two or three trees. And just shortly after that, we could hear another wave coming.
The second wave hit them, pulled the house out of the trees, and then back into the water. The whole family, mom and dad, brothers, sisters, and sister-in-law, and an infant, even the family dog, hung on for dear life.
I knew then that if we were going to die, that it was going to be a very slow death, and it wasn't going to be as quick and final as the first wave would have been. That this was really going to be awful because there were so many people on the roof.
Like the Eads brothers, the McRae family made it to safety when they could finally climb down from the roof of their house after being tossed back and forth by the waves and then into the trees.
The floor of the house was actually maybe 7 or 8 feet up in the air. And then sometime during the night, as pieces got tore off the house, we settled down onto the ground. And that's where we spent the next 13 hours.
It was snowing. They were soaked. They climbed into the attic and pulled insulation out of the walls to cover themselves to keep warm until daylight. Will Dunham says multiple tsunamis hit Seward in the aftermath of the quake. There were 7 in all, hitting different points around the little community.
There was one smaller one, but the biggest one, of course, they estimated at 50 feet high, and that was the one that came back. Then it mixed the debris and the boats.
The waves pushed fishing boats into trees, ripped houses apart, and twisted iron railroad tracks like swizzle sticks. Power lines toppled by the earthquake set Standard Oil's ruptured fuel tanks ablaze.
And so we could hear the explosions in towns.
But Dunham says the fires did some good.
What saved the town was everything blowing up and fire, which ran everybody to higher ground. And because the entire bay just literally exploded in fire, the tanker had just the day before unloaded a full load of fuel and what they call avgas and blazo and kerosene. They came in wooden cases called 2.5s, and those were going off and exploding just like you would, like a mortar in a ball in a field. Yeah, that's what sent most people to high ground.
The fire would eventually consume the waterfront. Flaming oil rode the tidal waves that came back to hammer downtown as far as 7th Avenue. Doug McRae.
The first tidal wave picked that burning fuel up and swept it all down what is 7th Avenue today, and then it swept it right into Tesoro, which was at the opposite end of town, and it ignited that fuel, plus what the railroad had. All their fuel cars were upside down and in a mess, and that fuel burned for days and days.
Further away from the waterfront, things were not much better. 3 bridges leading to the highway out of town were destroyed. The railroad tracks were ruined in spots from Portage on down, and the phone lines were out. Would help come, and from where? Imagine being thrown into this catastrophe without knowing it. Jay Grimes and his wife were driving down from Anchorage that afternoon to visit his wife's parents in Seward. Remember, there were no cell phones, no internet, few landlines, and in 1964, radio reception was spotty outside of Alaska's main cities. The Grimeses left Anchorage on a beautiful morning for a pleasant and as yet uneventful drive south. But about 5 miles from Seward, they noticed some cracks in the road. Nothing unusual, he remembers. First, they made jokes about road maintenance until they encountered a really big crack a couple of feet deep.
And we knew then that there had been a pretty bad earthquake. Well, just after we got across this first bad crack, Laura looked up in the sky and said, gee, that's a funny-looking cloud over there. And I looked too, and it did look strange. It looked just like it was coming from the town. And the longer we looked at it, the more we realized that this was something out of the ordinary. And then we decided that it was a fire and began to get worried. We were watching the smoke. Oh, we were still, I imagine, about 5 miles outside of town when we saw flames blaze up. I imagine the flames were going well over 100 feet in the air.
Suddenly, another car screamed by them, heading north.
A station wagon came just flying out from town and hit the bridge, and the bottom part of his car slammed against the bridge, and he bounced in the air and came over the bridge and slammed on his brakes and slid to a stop. And he screamed at us, "Turn around, turn around. There's a tidal wave coming. Seward's going to be washed away. Turn around, turn around." And then he took off.
Grimes did not turn around. He left his wife at a roadside cafe, then continued on until he came to a bridge into town that was impassable.
And I could see the flames billowing up, flames and smoke just pouring up out of the town. The flames were 100 to 150 feet in the air, and then huge clouds of black oily smoke that rose. I couldn't even guess how high they went into the air, but they were up higher than the mountain there beside the town, and the mountain's 3,000 feet tall.
Now, in a huge hurry, He made it the next 3 miles on foot, eventually encountering his in-laws stalled on the far side of a ruined bridge.
And, of course, when they got to the first of these three bridges on the town side, they saw that all three of them were popped up and there was no way of getting over them without walking. And then other cars began to pull in behind them, and they could look back and see what the wave was doing to the town, and they knew that there had been other people behind them that were trying to get across this road. And they knew that they had barely beat the wave across, and they didn't know how many people had been on the lagoon or on the lagoon road when the wave came across.
The three returned on foot to his car. They picked up his wife and all made it back to a lumber camp up the highway that was owned by a friend. They spent the night there.
And we were up and down all night long because of more earthquakes. We listened to the Anchorage radio station as much as we possibly could. People would come out from town and stop by and talk with us. And finally, about 3 o'clock in the morning, we got to sleep. And just shortly after daylight the next morning, of course, all during this time, there was no electricity. No lights at all, no way to cook or anything like this. So the next morning we got up and built a wood fire in the yard and cooked breakfast.
You are listening to KSKA and a special edition of A Closer Look. I'm Ellen Lockyer. That's the actual sound of the Good Friday earthquake captured on this footage taken in Anchorage. It went on for almost 5 minutes.
This is radio station KENI in Anchorage, Alaska, broadcasting under emergency conditions.
14 hours after the earthquake hit, Alaska's biggest city was staggering to its feet. On the morning of March 28th, radio station KENI, operating on a generator and with only one phone line working, did its best to get information out.
Nick Gushin, Don Abel is concerned for your whereabouts and your safety to get you. We're now back.
This is the sound of the actual broadcast made on shortwave radio.
Damaged radio antenna at Bootlegger's Cove, and we are transmitting now just about full power, 5,000 watts. So we'll be getting out of the outlying areas. You people who are hearing us for the first time out there, President Johnson has declared portions of Alaska hit by the earthquake and tidal waves last night as they disaster areas, and aftershocks are still in various parts of this.
Perhaps Jay Grimes and his crew up the road outside of Seward were tuning in, as some of the broadcast was being picked up by ham radio operators and relayed to the outside world.
They've lost power in the building there, emergency standby power, but we're still operating by radio, shortwave radios. So we still have communications, and everything is proceeding as well as can be expected under the circumstances.
KENI board operators stayed on the air, taking messages on the one incoming phone line, then relaying requests for help, emergency equipment, doctors and nurses, and then broadcasting messages out.
Okay. More and more information pouring into our one and only phone line here. We can receive calls. We cannot make any calls. Our phone circuits are all out of commission in the building. Kenai.
Could I make a collect call from Boston, Massachusetts?
No, I'm sorry, ma'am. We can't relay them any right now at the time being because the lines are just clogged.
The working long-distance lines located in Fairbanks were jammed.
Well, ACS says that the long-distance circuits from Fairbanks to the outside are just jammed. They are way, way behind. They have a limited number of operators and a limited number of lines and circuits to the states. So we're going to have to wait until we get caught up before we can get any further messages outside. The best hope that we can have on immediate contact, radio contact, would be the ham radio operators setting up a central point for the distribution of these messages on the whereabouts of families and friends by setting up a central ham radio operator location and relaying by ham radios long down the line. That's about the only hope we have for right now in that particular department.
Grimes and his father-in-law decided to walk back to downtown Seward to see what they could do to help. With each step, things looked worse.
Almost 2 miles from the waterfront, sitting in a pasture back away from the water, was about a 16-foot cabin cruiser just setting up on dry land about 200 yards from any water. There was a big barge, about 4 or 5 large boats, not just little fishing boats or anything like that, but big boats. The smaller boats, like rowboats and fishing boats, were just completely smashed to pieces. There was nothing left but just kindling wood of them. Telephone poles snapped off, trash and boards and junk and logs and boxes laying all over the place. This lagoon, which is usually clear, clean water, was covered with oil.
Downtown, waves from several sources had flattened the waterfront. A U.S. Geological Survey study later reported that an underwater landslide beneath Seward's waterfront and a bathtub or sloshing wave effect in Resurrection Bay and the displacement of water from the earthquake fracture on the floor of Prince William Sound all contributed to the devastation. Waves started right after the initial big shock and continued until 11:30 p.m. the night of March 27th. Eyewitnesses reported that people ran down to the beach to get away from the fires because burning oil covered the water surface and ruined buildings in town. It was then they noticed something ominous. The water in the bay had receded further than anyone had ever remembered. They ran for their lives. In the aftermath of the disaster, KENI Radio in Anchorage put out the call for ham radio operators to help as frantic relatives tried to locate loved ones.
Once again, to put out a plea to the ham radio operators that as soon as they have the communication system set up to the lower 48, please notify us at KENI Radio and we will start relaying messages down to the south 48 and vice versa.
And word was beginning to come into Anchorage about the fate of other communities.
Okay, we'll try to get word over there. Kodiak has been hit by a tidal wave, and there's a lot of water over there, and considerable damage, I understand, and we'll try to get word.
Well, I suppose so. Thanks.
You bet. Mm-hmm. Everybody, please stay home. Please stay home or wherever you are and remain calm. Everything will work out just fine. Everything will work out fine. Just stay home and don't panic. Help is on the way. We have Air Force military planes coming, either getting ready to leave for Alaska or en route to Alaska with medical supplies and equipment and personnel. They're going to be airlifted to here in many, many transport planes. There, President Johnson has declared Alaska a disaster area, and we will receive the fullest assistance from the federal government.
Kodiak had been hit hard, but Valdez was the closest to the epicenter. More than 20 people had been fishing off of Valdez Pier at 5:36 on March 27th. They were lost to the sea, but most others made it to safety.
Seward Highway is closed. Here is a bulletin from Valdez. The Valdez Police Chief, L.E. Smith, says most of the town's 1,900 residents are in automobiles on the road outside of town. They have evacuated the city. They expect to return to town in an hour or so, but Smith plans to try to keep the city evacuated due to the lack of water supply and very poor sanitation conditions. He says, the Valdez Chief of Police says there are 3 known dead, 26 missing from the pier, and 2 badly injured people in the Valdez area. The vessel, the boat, the Chena, is standing by and is okay. And the Coast Guard cutter Sedge from Cordova also is at Valdez and is okay, and the crews of these vessels are helping out. The military is still trying to get men and supplies from Fort Wainwright down to Valdez over the Richardson Highway. All right, that's a report from Valdez by the Chief of Police, L.E. Smith. The city has been evacuated, 1,900 people. They're all in automobiles on the road outside town.
As morning broke in Seward, the extent of the damage became clear. The airstrip was washed out, the railroad in ruins, and the devastated bridges on the road out of town were keeping those with working cars from reaching the highway. The highway itself was impassable further north. The waterfront docks were simply gone.
Utter destruction of gigantic proportion. I don't even think they make words that describe how enormous the destruction was and how Mother Nature can just take everything from huge fishing boats and crab boats and set them up in pastures and take railroad ties and twist them into little knots and put police cars under Texaco oil trucks.
Linda McSwain recalls the McRae family had finally been able to climb down from the subdivision house roof. Brother Doug had gone into town to seek help.
And it seemed like he was gone a long time. But pretty soon, coming from the head of the bay, it was my brother, and he had people from the Red Cross, and they were walking. So we were put on the assumed dead list. And that's pretty, it just makes you feel very grateful. There aren't really words to describe how you feel when you see that assumed dead. And to be able to say, no, we're fine, we're okay.
Soon, the military began shipping in cargo planes to Fairbanks. Only helicopters were flying in Anchorage and in Seward. An Army video captured this transmission.
We're bringing down a transmitter, 250-watt transmitter from station RAPA at Raymond, Washington, which has been donated by that station to the town of Seward, Alaska. This town was pretty well devastated by the tidal wave and earthquake last Friday, and we're without communications or without entertainment or anything of this nature.
Seward's local station was swept into a lagoon by the second wave. And there were some small strokes of good fortune. Remember, this was during the Cold War. Seward had been designated a safe city, one that would be a safe haven in the event of a nuclear attack. The civil defense kept a cache there of food, medical supplies, and all kinds of emergency items needed in case of a disaster. Evacuees were housed in schools and in Seward's military facility. Will Dunham.
He opened up that and used those supplies to set up field kitchens, places for the people to sleep, and set up cots.
And the death toll, 13 in Seward, was astonishingly low considering the wrath of the catastrophe. Dunham says because Seward city officials were in Anchorage for a municipal conference on March 27th, Seward's All-American City celebration, set for that date, was postponed. Hundreds would have been sitting on the docks for the ceremony if it had gone forward. Dunham says in the days after the disaster, some people were so scared they wanted to run, but others wanted to rebuild.
The thing we did right is we immediately tried to transfer people's thoughts from being, what the hell am I going to do, to what am I doing now? Because there's nothing as desolate as to all of a sudden, you have nothing. And my God, what am I going to do?
Federal emergency money started coming into town, and everyone who could got to work.
We actually had power back in 3 days. We had generators. We had power equipment flowing in. We had crews come from all over. We had power back in town in 3 days. We were also laying water line. And it was probably not acceptable today, but it worked then. Aluminum piping down here and on top of the ground to supply water. And you set up sanitation, whatever you needed for sanitation and pits. And the town was functioning.
Dunham says city officials immediately started putting work crews together.
Because we wanted to be sure we got an income flow to the people who had lost everything.
He says the biggest city challenge after the calamity was a psychological one. people with nothing, had to keep busy, keep focused, and keep looking to the future.
And one of the things we decided right away is because of everybody, people had lost their jobs completely. We wanted to put everybody to work. So we set a program up where I started enrolling people and sent them out on jobs, routine jobs, and whatever they were doing. We paid them $2 an hour.
And the city reopened its schools mostly as a ploy to keep people in town. If the kids are returning to a normal routine, it helps the parents focus on staying put and rebuilding. The school children got to work, too. Many of the elementary students used crayons to draw their impressions of March 27th on construction paper. Those Crayola masterpieces still exist. You are listening to A Closer Look on KSKA. The Good Friday earthquake immediately passed into legend. News reports of the time focused on the immense damage, the awe-inspiring stories of survival, and the role of the U.S. government in providing relief. Audio from a U.S. Army newsreel produced sometime afterward painted a grim picture of loss in Valdez.
The Chena comes into Valdez, the first ship the townspeople have seen in over 4 months. The Chena brings work to the people who have come down to the long dock to unload. It is March 27th, Good Friday. Although it is late in the afternoon, two of the crewmen, Fred Neumayer and Ernest Nelson, try to get some pictures with their 8mm camera. Suddenly, the whole harbor of Valdez is sucked dry. Out in the Gulf of Alaska, the ocean bottom seems to sink, then heaves upward 50 feet, sending a giant wave toward shore. It tosses the Chena high and then smashes it down where the dock had been. The harbor of Valdez is a seething whirlpool. The dock splinters, then disappears into the earth. No one on it will survive.
Similar reports captured the terror in Seward.
The second wave appeared to be approximately 30 feet high, and it was carrying boats, burning debris from the docks. And this was the last I saw of the tidal wave as I turned around on that highway and ran as fast as I could back in the direction of the country store.
And the fire was so spectacular that I had so much worry for my wife in town, I didn't watch to see what was happening on the lagoon road until the wave came over the railroad trestle. It didn't look like water. It looked like about 40 feet of rolling timbers and boats and a few house roofs that I don't know where they came from. I turned and ran from it as fast as I could, and a woman ahead of me stopped her car and opened the back door. When she did this, I just ricocheted into the back seat, and she yelled, "Let's get out of here." And we made it up the Derry Hill just ahead of the water.
To this day, the Derry Hill is the safe point in Seward's tsunami evacuation route. The Good Friday earthquake also fascinated scientists who admitted they had no idea why it had occurred. The U.S. Geological Survey sent three researchers to Alaska to find out. One of them, George Plafker, figured it out in terms of a new theory called plate tectonics.
The oceanic crust is being pushed underneath that part of southern Alaska at a very low angle, and there was slip on the interface between the oceanic crust and the overlying continental crust.
The two crusts are converging at a rate of 1.5 inches a year. Slip between the crusts periodically causes megaquakes, like the 1964 event.
One of the obvious things that everybody wants to know when you have an earthquake like this is how frequently do they occur?
The scientists discovered that megathrust earthquakes had occurred in South Central Alaska 9 times over a 5,500-year period. Average time between each, 600 years. The quake triggered tidal waves in Hawaii, California, and Oregon, causing many deaths outside Alaska. 119 of them were due to local tsunamis. Damage was estimated to be about $500 million in 1964 dollars. Some years afterward, Valdez Mayor George Gilson recalled,
"Our docks and entire waterfront area slid out into deep water, and of course, very soon we had a small tidal wave, but fortunately the tide was out, and we didn't get wet like we might have if the tide had been fuller. But the serious tidal wave that caused all the damage came in at about 10:30 in the evening, some 5 hours later."
The researchers found that land underneath Valdez was so earthquake-prone, the town site had to be moved before rebuilding could begin. The original town sank 5 feet. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers immediately sent in assessment crews. The Corps had the funds and the authority to react in times of disaster, according to the Corps' Warren George.
"The first job was to take care of acute safety problems, water supply, dangerous situations that should be roped off and people protected from injury. Salvage operations. This was really the initial response."
Utilities, schools, and boat harbors had priority for the first reconstruction efforts. Those efforts were aimed at rebuilding community economy. In Seward, people were scared. Many wanted out of town as quickly as possible.
"There was a considerable exodus. Of course, everything was gone."
Will Dunham says the Longshoremen's Union offered subsidies for dock workers wishing to relocate.
"We had 245 registered men on the dock, and of those 245, probably 200 of them were fully registered union people. So what the union did, we petitioned the International to offer them an opportunity to move, transfer to ports out in the lower 48, all along the West Coast. So the union put up $1,000 moving cost for everybody who wanted to move. About 100 of them moved."
But half of them stayed. After debris cleanup teams were organized, Dunham, who was in charge of matching survivors to meaningful work, began looking for other things people could do. Resourceful best describes that effort.
"I hired a whole bunch of chicken pluckers."
A chicken farm in Seward had housed thousands of chickens, but with no electricity and no feed for them, the birds were butchered and turned into meals cooked at the field kitchens. The grim duty of looking for those who perished was complicated by the destruction of the seafood processing plants.
"They had literally hundreds of cases of octopus chunks, which were the bait. Well, of course, the tidal wave and everything mixed all these pieces up, and we were looking for missing people. And the octopus flesh looks an awful lot like human flesh when it's washed. And it was, the debris was just filled with chunks of octopus."
Seward was in ruins, and so was the town's economy, which had been based primarily on moving cargo from incoming ships to Alaska Railroad's outgoing freight cars. But, Dunham says, the disaster marked the beginning of a new Seward. These days, Seward City Manager Jim Hunt occupies the office in the City Administration Building at 6th and Adams.
"I see the earthquake, economically. At the time, I think it was already fairly well known across Alaska, and especially here in Seward, that Anchorage was taking over as the hub, economic hub. It had already done so for years and years. And while it was, I would say probably stable, and I've studied it and read about it and spoke to people, here and gone. I wouldn't say it was the best thing that could ever happen, but it was a remarkable change from the path that they were on. the economy and as far as industry. And after the earthquake, economically, the community was dead. You know, and you've probably seen in videos and specials where the reconstruction, almost like a work program, WPF or PA effort, and they began to literally reconstruct everything in the community, but they still didn't have a foundation, an anchor. And that came in the form of, and I have the book here on my table, is Icicle Seafoods. Processors saw an opportunity here, an opportunity to help themselves, to help the community in South Central, and they built their processing plant. And really, if you ask anybody here, and I wholeheartedly believe it, they saved the community. It provided jobs, a sense of belonging, a sense of worth and respect. And the fishing vessels began coming in, the trawlers and fishermen, and began offloading here. And otherwise, who knows what would have happened? Because nobody else was coming.
Hunt says now the community of roughly 2,500 residents is doing very well economically. He calls the city a little diamond and says its economy is making it shine. Aside from the fish processing plant, there's a potential deal with the Community Development Quota Group to homeport its Bering Sea fleet in Seward. Shell Oil used Seward facilities for a summer, as does Foss Marine. The city is in the process of acquiring a dry dock. Avtech is located there, as is a major state corrections facility. And then there is tourism, lots and lots of tourism, which brings its own headaches. The primary one is, what if it happened again?
I don't get a lot of sleep during that period. The tourist season can be worrisome because it could be, you know, an outbreak, you know, of a virus. It could be fire. It could be tsunami. It could be earthquake. We have a lot of live practice, which keeps us sharp.
But there is always something that is not anticipated, he says.
But you go to bed at night, despite all your training and experience and life experience, and there's still that little tweaking in the back of your mind. What did we forget? If it happened right now, what did we forget? And what could we do?
He outlines a scenario that is anticipated in some disaster drills.
The most likely event, if something happened during the season, the tourist season, if we had an earthquake, is the three bridges right at our corporate limits north of town. The three bridges are going down. Will be essentially cut off from the world.
The city coordinates with the Kenai Peninsula Borough and with the state on emergency response. Hunt says nowadays emergency preparedness training and interagency cooperation would make response to a disaster different from 50 years ago.
It would be a different event today if it happened.
Hunt says that in the event of another megaquake in South Central Alaska, Seward's small population would most likely not work in its favor.
The state's going to respond, yes, but Anchorage and the Valley are going to be of a primary concern. We know that. We know that. And we have to, you know, that Seward being known in this area, part of the peninsula, a little independent streak, we know that if we lose our extension cord, we have our generators, if we lose that, we have to survive. We have to be prepared. We absolutely have to be prepared. And along with the rest of the Kenai, we know that.
Seward, with its half dozen police officers and 30 or so volunteer firemen, would have to face calamity on its own.
And if it was anywhere in high season or 4th of July, we could have an extra 25,000 people in town, and we'd have to deal with shelter, because it's still cool in the summertime, shelter, food, water. And that's when individual preparedness is really going to come into play.
Most Seward residents are aware of emergency tsunami response.
Well, as anyone in government or emergency planning knows, or public protection, you send out notices with the electric bills, you post them at the post office, it's on the radio, it's in the newspapers, but you can never get 100%. And that's, we have to work with that knowledge that we know we can do the best we can with all of our evacuation and notices, but we know we're not going to get everyone, and that can be distressing.
Across from the Alaska Sea Life Center at the edge of Resurrection Bay, a bright blue sign warns of a tsunami danger area, and similar signs bearing the legend Tsunami Escape Route dot the roads leading to the highest streets where First and Jefferson intersect. And with summer comes a stream of tourists by car, bus, ship, and air. Many of them don't speak English. Are they informed of escape routes?
And I wonder if, in the last, from Moose Pass down, if they get the talk, the speech, if they get the two-minute speech, if the earth starts shaking here, what to do? And I would guess that they don't. You know, we could have, you know, 8, 10, 15 coaches in town. We might have the ships coming and going, offloading, the train, coaches coming in, you know, with the schedule shift, morning and evening. Do those people, are they told as they come in what to do?
Hunt says sometimes during summer events, the town's population swells to the point where if a calamity were to occur, city services would most likely be overwhelmed. That's Seward's tsunami warning siren.
Seward was the first tsunami-ready community in the state of Alaska.
Eddie Athey is Seward's fire chief.
And the folks that came before me, they worked their tails off to get there. And, you know, so we take that, we factor that all in, and we use that and whatever new information we can share with folks to continue promoting preparedness throughout our community. I feel we are prepared. Is there more we could do? Absolutely. And we're going to continue to strive to do that.
The city fire department is in charge of evacuation in case of a tsunami event.
Essentially, the goal is to get folks away from the beach area and get them uphill and away. You know, and the thought process is that if they can collect there, then we can do something after the wave subsides. But, you know, the goal is to get them out of the path of this incoming wave and uphill and away from where they normally would be.
It's been a while since the townsfolk heard the wail of the siren, but they'll be hearing it during tsunami drills on the morning of March 27th this year. The night of the actual Good Friday earthquake in 1964, local police used an old Jeep to drive through town. Power failure had silenced the siren, so they used a hand-cranked siren and shouted door to door, "Get out! Get out! Get to high ground!" Things are a lot different now.
Depending on whether it's a locally generated tsunami or a distant tsunami, the local ones, we're not going to have time to go door to door, neighborhood to neighborhood. It's just not possible. But the ones that are coming from far away that give us a little bit of time, we break the waterfront area down into management zones. And then I take a fire truck and a bunch of firefighters and we go through that neighborhood and, you know, door to door if we have time. Otherwise, it's, you know, sirens and lights going on the PA system saying, you know, tsunami, you know, is coming. Evacuate to high ground.
Tsunami alerts start at the National Tsunami Warning Center in Palmer. Operators there relay analysis and guidance and issue alert levels to the state and to communities. But the emergency alert system is activated by the National Weather Service. That warning is the unmistakable insect-like buzzing that interrupts television and radio programming. The Tsunami Warning Center has a dedicated communication line to the National Weather Service, which in turn alerts the state. But the actual warning siren is triggered at the community level. Athey says the command comes from the Kenai Peninsula Borough Office of Emergency Operations, but the siren can be triggered from Seward. Waves can come in for hours, if not days, after a quake. A big wave starts an oscillation or bathtub effect in a harbor or bay, causing consecutive tsunamis that can go on for days. The bathtub effect in Resurrection Bay sent waves rolling into Seward from the time of the quake until almost midnight. Athey says a couple of years ago he had a disturbing experience.
2 years ago, there was the live tone went out and the sirens went off around the state and it really didn't pertain to our local area. And we responded down to the beach area, and it was middle of summer, lots of campers down there. And unfortunately, folks, because there was no earthquake that went along with it, most folks were like, well, what am I supposed to do? You know, and you have to tell them, look, just because there was no earthquake does not mean that there's not a tsunami coming. When the siren goes off, you have to evacuate. And, you know, this is not a test. This is go to high ground. And folks were not heeding that. And so we have to do our best to, you know, encourage them that when they hear those sirens, they go to high ground.
People who reside in Seward would know how to do that, although visitors may not understand. In June of 2011, a 7.2 earthquake felt in the Aleutians failed to trigger the tsunami warning siren in the Kenai Peninsula borough, but a later alert meant to cancel the warning set off sirens. City manager Jim Hunt doubles as Seward's emergency operations director. He says there is one simple rule.
If it shakes more than 20 seconds, if it starts shaking and it's unstable, they say 20 seconds, it's likely a 7.0 or larger, run for your life. Everybody knows to run up towards the mountain, towards Marathon. They know, run for the trees.
If there is a serious threat, Fire Chief Athey says, volunteer firemen can be contacted at a moment's notice these days.
All of our volunteers carry some form of communication, a radio, a pager, something of that nature. And so it's relatively quick for us to get our fingers on them by pushing the magic button and saying, come here, we need you.
But Hunt points to Seward's relatively small public safety force in the event of an emergency.
We might only have 30, 40%, 50% turnout, depending on where they are. They could be around town. They could be at other side of the bay in which they'd be cut off, completely isolated. There are so many factors. We literally just have to play the cards that are handed to us when it happens.
Hunt says individual preparedness for an emergency is a must. Families are urged to prepare for eventualities, to keep supplies on hand to cover a 5 to 7 day period in the event that power and water utilities fail. Water is essential, a gallon a day for every member of the household for a week. And dried or canned foods, non-perishables, and high-energy foods like trail mix and peanut butter need to be stored in a safe place. Batteries, flashlights, even a manual can opener are a must. If there was a bad earthquake or tsunami at the height of tourist season, having local people prepared could be an invaluable help.
And that's when individual preparedness is really going to come into play, because our services would likely be overwhelmed.
Hunt says Seward suffered floods last fall, and every emergency event helps the city learn to deal with one more thing.
You know, we work with the borough by radio contact. And that's the ideal situation, that we still have radios and cell phones. In the event of a serious emergency, we will be down to a ham radio and maybe two-way radios. So we do work in concert. We do communicate closely and work closely with the school systems, you know, in the event, you know, we need them as a shelter for people. In our last flooding event, we had an issue with animals out in the borough, and we were working with the borough and working people to see what we could do to help them. One family had several animals, and it was a question. We knew the borough couldn't do anything, so, you know, we did what we could to help them out.
And if you feel the ground shaking while you're indoors, rescue teams that have responded to earthquakes around the world advocate use of the drop, cover, and hold on protocol. Drop to the ground, take cover under a sturdy table, and hold on till the shaking stops. Research shows that earthquake injuries, for the most part, come from people being hit by shattered glass or falling objects, rather than being inside a collapsed building. The Great Alaska Shakeout exercise, set for March 27th to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the 1964 quake, is actually part of a nationwide drill. Simulated disaster response drills are set for Anchorage and smaller communities statewide. Seward will, of course, participate, but how will the public respond? 50 years ago, neighbors helped each other deal with a disaster that no one had dreamed possible. Would that be true today?
It's still here. We're still small enough, but it's still here. I believe that everybody here would be their better selves and reach down and do the right thing.
The Great Alaska Earthquake of 1964 stands as the most powerful recorded in U.S. history and remains the second largest ever recorded. According to the U.S. Geological Survey, the 1964 earthquake occurred at a pivotal time in the development of plate tectonic theory. That event ushered in an era of major geologic and geophysical field investigation and helped to produce a generation of scientists who immersed themselves in the study of plate tectonics. But even for those not versed in geology, the memory of that awful day is indelible. It survives in video, in sound, in photos, and now on YouTube. Reminders of the quake are everywhere in Seward, in the city building codes, and in land use planning, and in emergency response drills, in the hunks of metal wreckage and the twisted train rails still buried in wetlands around town, and in children's art.
This one is Sula Van, now Sula McClure, who's our borough representative. So I think that the direction's a little, I don't know where how that's supposed to go, but this thing's falling down in the house, and then... I think these are tankers on fire. And the fire is a pretty common theme in these.
Oh, look. Margarita Sinclair. Look at that.
Mm-hmm. Let out by someone in a raincoat.
Keith Lindsay.
Some of them are a little more literal than others. Second grade, some all the way up to seventh and eighth, so...
Remember those Crayola masterpieces the school children drew in the aftermath of the great earthquake? Those long-ago kids have left their impressions of that day in crayon. Back at the city's museum, Kate Ruland unwraps a few.
At the beginning of the earthquake, there were people who thought, you know, the Russians had started bombing them, so...
Oh, my word, that's Cliff Buck. Grade one. Pretty good for grade one.
Yeah. I think those are supposed to be waves, you know, with the earth churned up in them, kind of white caps on top.
Playing again? That's great. And the colors? Kids are born artists.
Yeah.
Chris, looking at a fire through a busted window. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Wow, he could see.
They've been carefully stored between sheets of tissue paper and packed away for safekeeping. The Seward Library Museum plans to exhibit them to honor the anniversary of the Great Alaska Earthquake. For A Closer Look, I'm Ellen Lockyer.
KSKA would like to thank Alaska's Digital Archives and the Alaska Film Archives for the use of sound for this production. We heard the voices of Linda McRae McSwain, Doug McRae, Jay Grimes, and Mac and Bob Eads, as well as many anonymous speakers whose comments were recorded in the past. We had help from the Seward Community Library Association production Waves Over Seward and from the Seward Library Museum. Additional audio courtesy of the United States Geological Survey and Carl Vertrees. Of course, thanks to Kate Ruland, Will Dunham, Jim Hunt, and Eddie Athey for their participation. Dave Waldron assisted with technical expertise, and Tristan Sammons helped with production. Piano composition Wide Open, written and performed by Radoslav Lorkovic. A Closer Look is a production of KSKA Anchorage.